All right, so I'm supposed to give a course on L functions for GLN is really what it's on. L functions for GLN is developed by integral representations, and then towards the end also the current state of the converse theorem and how you use the converse theorem for doing liftings or functoriality. So what I plan is the following, particularly because in giving a course like this at a place where you, well, I know a few people, there are a few faces that I know here, but not all of them, you never quite know what everybody knows. So what I actually plan on doing today is doing all of classical Hecke theory, so classical modular forms from the beginning to the end, or at least the kinds of things that I'm going to need. That way, because what I'm going to do for automorphic representations on GLN is supposed to parallel what Hecke did for classical modular forms. So today we're just going to do classical modular forms basically as Hecke did them. Then I'm going to spend a couple of lectures doing the transition from classical modular forms to automorphic representations. Most of that's fairly standard. I won't prove much. I'll just tell you what things look like. The only difference from standard theory is that I'll spend some time talking about what are called smooth automorphic forms, because I'll need those when I do local L functions over R and C. Then I'll probably give, I don't know, 5 or 6 talks on doing the theory of L functions for automorphic representations on GLN via integral representations. It's sort of scattered through the literature, but I'll sort of do it from beginning to the end, at least tell you what it looks like. I won't have time to prove everything. And then I'll spend a couple of lectures talking about the converse theorem, how you prove it, how it relates both to the classical theory and to the theory in terms of automorphic representations. And then I'll spend a couple of lectures talking about how you use the converse theorem to do liftings from classical groups to GLN and work out some of the details, or at least explain some of the details for the lifting from the odd orthogonal group to GLN. So that's what I plan. So it's about, it'll take me to the end of April, I think. So. Okay, but today it's just classical modular forms as you can find in Hecke's collected works, pretty much. So, H is going to be the upper half plane. Okay. Both SL2R or, let's say, GL2R positive determinant act on H. And they act by linear fractional transformations. So A, B, C, D acting on Z is AZ plus B over CZ plus D. So this, I use Z for my variable here. Now I'll be interested in certain discrete groups of motions. Yes. This is just the linear fraction. This is just the action on the upper half plane. This is not the. No. Mm-mm. No, not here. That's all I want. I want the center to act trivially. Yeah. So I'm going to be interested in certain discrete group of motions, such that the quotient is finite volume. And really, I'm only going to consider two examples. I'm going to consider the full modular group, SL2Z, which I'll remind you is generated by two transformations. Whoops. Okay. and this fact is going to be important to us. The fundamental domain for the action, let me remind you of that. Here's the upper half plane. Here's the circle, C equals 1. Here are the two lines at a half. And here is a closed fundamental domain. Okay, so T acts by translation, so T identifies these, and S, the inversion, identifies these. And when you fold this up, you see that gamma mod H is essentially sphere minus the point at infinity. Okay? So this is one discrete group. We'll mainly work with this one. We will also talk about the Hecke congruence groups, gamma naught of n. And this is the subset of the full modular group where you put a congruence condition on this entry. And this is a finite index in SL2Z. And I don't remember what the index is. There's a nice formula for it. So let's see, these groups also preserve the rational points on the boundary of the upper half plane, so they preserve Q and the point at infinity. And so I'm going to let H star be H union these points. Okay. Well, so gamma acts on H star, and gamma mod H star is then can be given the structure of a compact Riemann surface. Okay. Now these points, so, and it's actually the gamma orbits of these sort of boundary points that you've added are called the cusps of gamma. Right, in general, like the picture here, H mod gamma is going to be look like some Riemann surface minus a finite number of points. And what this does is this fills in those finite number of points. Usually, the picture you usually see is something with a bunch of horns coming off of it, and you're filling in the horns. Okay? And you can always find, so given any cusp, you can always find an element of SL2Q that sends that cusp to infinity. And so if you sort of want to know what's going on at any cusp, you can conjugate your group and send the cusp off to infinity, and the picture is more or less like what happens here. You have an open piece that's going up to it. So let me just say that locally, all cusps look more or less like the cusp at infinity. Okay. I guess it doesn't matter what order. That's the one that goes up. So let me now tell you what a modular form is. Modular forms are a special class of functions on the upper half plane. So a modular form, so here's a definition, holomorphic modular form of integral weight k, bigger than or equal to 0, is a function, f, complex-valued function on the upper half plane, such that it should satisfy three conditions. The first one is a condition of modularity. Oh, wait a minute. So modular form of weight k bigger than 0, I forgot my group, for gamma, such that, well, there's a modularity condition which says that f of gamma z is equal to cz plus d to the k f of z for all gamma, small gamma, and gamma. So that's the condition of modularity. So that's, in some sense, the most important condition. There's a condition of regularity. Which here just says that f of z is holomorphic. So I'm looking at holomorphic functions on the upper half plane. And then there's a third condition, which I'm going to describe as a growth condition. And this growth condition, in some sense, is telling me the behavior of the functions as I go out towards one of the cusps. I'll show you how to think about it as a growth condition in one of these fundamental domains. But for this context, what I can say is that f extends holomorphically over every cusp. Okay, I want to explain this growth condition a little bit. Let me just take. So for right now, the two examples that I've given actually sit inside SL2Z. Okay. So unless I say otherwise, I'm going to be talking about one of these two examples, or in general, a subgroup of finite index in SL2Z. Okay. I will talk about what happens when you have determinant at some point. But for right now, unless I say otherwise, I'm going to be talking about one of these two examples. Because I think this is basically what Hecke talked about, are these examples. Okay, so the explanation of three is sort of the following. In both of these examples, you have the translation in gamma. Okay? So for a modular form, so by modularity, if you look at what this action is, this is f of z plus 1. And if you apply modularity, this is just f of z. Okay? So modular forms are periodic in z goes to z plus 1. Okay? Moreover, in fact, t generates the stabilizer in gamma of the cusp at infinity. Okay? And the stabilizer I'll call gamma sub infinity. And if you look at gamma infinity, my the upper half plane, in this picture, gamma infinity is just this translation, and t is just translation by 1. Gamma infinity, H mod gamma infinity, the fundamental domain for that would just be the strip, and so what I'm doing is I'm folding it around. And so this is either a cylinder, or you can think of it as a punctured disk centered at, let's say, centered at the point at infinity. Okay. Now, if I think of it in terms of a punctured disk, and I take a local parameter at infinity, I'll call this disk D, can be, you can take it to be Q, or Q infinity, and that's e to the 2 pi I z. And the map, then z to Q, sends either H, well, it goes through gamma infinity mod H, to a certain punctured disk. And this is the point 0 now, because this map sends the point at infinity to the origin of this disk. Now, the function f is going to be holomorphic on this punctured disk. Because we haven't affected that by taking the quotient. So now, holomorphic on this punctured disk, and then I'm going to be, whether I use f of z or use a local parameter q, I'm going to mix these things. And so it has a Laurent expansion. At the point q equals 0. And so what that looks like, and here I told you I was going to mix and match my notation, if I express this in the parameter q, you get a Laurent expansion that could have positive and negative parts. And then the growth condition, the holomorphic, extends holomorphically over every cusp, then just says that I want this to be holomorphic on the disk. So then, holomorphic at infinity means that an is equal to 0 for n less than 0. Okay? So that means that you can actually write f of z in the expansion starting at n equals 0, an q to the n. And if I write this back in terms of now really the function z, you get the sum n equals 0 to infinity, a n e to the 2 pi I n z. And this is what is called either the Q expansion or the Fourier expansion of the modular form f at infinity. So this is the okay. And then you can do the same thing at any cusp. Okay, you move the cusp off to infinity. You may conjugate the group around. The group translations may be a little bit bigger. Cusps may be wider, but you can do the same thing. You have an expansion at every cusp, and you put on such a condition on the Fourier expansion. So given this, we can now define a cusp form. Well, let's let MK gamma denote the space of modular forms. This is sort of classical notation. Modular forms of weight K for gamma. So it's the space of all functions like this. Oh, I should point out that for my two examples, which I've now erased, both SL2Z and gamma naught of n, minus 1 sits in both of these. And if you look at what this condition of modularity says for minus the identity, it tells you that for such functions to be non-zero, the weight has to be even. But if minus 1's not in the group, you don't have such a condition. Yes? Well, one reason is from here it doesn't look very natural to be called a growth condition, but once you go to sort of general automorphic forms, that really is a growth condition. Okay? Or if you want to think about it in terms of the behavior of this function at the point zero, right, what I've done is I've ruled out a singularity. I've ruled out bad growth as Q goes to zero. Okay? Now, oftentimes, this growth condition says that f is of moderate growth, okay? Where here it looks like, well, it just extends, and it looks like you could have various other sorts of growth. If you look at it in the parameter z, though, right, if I had any negative Fourier coefficients here, when I look at this as a function of z as I go off to infinity, this has if I have any Fourier coefficients for negative n, this becomes exponentially growing as I go up the cusp. So if I even say I want sub-exponential growth of any sort, sort of moderate growth, with this regularity, I'm led to this. So it really is, it can be interpreted as a growth condition. And when you get away from holomorphic modular forms and just general automorphic forms on groups, it really does get replaced by a growth condition. So that's why already here I've written growth condition. Okay. Also, it was sort of classically known that these three conditions, the condition of modularity, regularity, and this growth condition, are enough to imply strong finiteness conditions on this space. And so one of the sort of first fundamental theorems is that this space is finite dimensional. Okay. And for SL2Z, they're nice formulas for it. Actually, for any of the congruence groups, you can write down reasonable formulas for this dimension. And in this context of holomorphic forms, this is basically Riemann-Roch. And Riemann-Roch applied to, so now let's just say the proof is Riemann-Roch applied to powers from the canonical bundle on this compact Riemann surface. And so Riemann-Roch will give you computations of actually what the dimension is. But for us, it's not going to matter what the dimension is. But we will see similar statements when we get to the general theory of finite dimensionality, so I wanted to mention that. Okay. All right, let me now define cusp forms, because they're going to be the functions that we're interested in for the most part. So a cusp form of weight k, for gamma is a modular form, so it's one of these functions which actually vanishes at all the cusps. Okay. So in terms of the Fourier expansion, here's where the Fourier expansion comes from. It comes from looking at f on the disk, and I now want it to vanish at the cusp at infinity, so vanish here at q equals 0, and that just says that a 0 is 0, okay, with a similar condition at every cusp. So in terms of the Fourier expansion, this becomes that f of z, that the Fourier expansion starts off at the n equals 1 term. And, of course, similarly for every cusp. There'll be an expansion about that cusp, and they must also start with the n equals 1 term. Okay. Now, I wanted at this point just to give some examples. I realize, well, actually, I guess I don't really realize that this is a review for most people. But still, I would like to give some examples just to, so I'll be able to make a point later on. So here's some classical examples of modular forms. Okay. So first one are the classical Eisenstein series. So I take k bigger than 2, even. Then gk of z is the sum over pairs of integers, not zero, and you take m z plus n to the minus k. Okay. This guarantees convergence, and then you can, it's not too hard to check from here that this is actually a modular form of weight k for SL2z. Okay. You can work out its Fourier expansion. Its Fourier expansion starts off with 2 zeta k plus 2. Let's see if I can, you better let me check this before you write it down. I'm seeing if I can remember this. So it's got the zeta function in it, the gamma function in it. It's got the divisor, the power divisor function in it. Is that right? No, I think the Bernoulli numbers come out of this. This isn't normal. No, this is you take this sum, just sort of the most straightforward thing to write down, and then you get this. And then the normalized one, usually you normalize it so that the first, so it's not a cusp form, because here's its constant Fourier coefficient at infinity, and you usually normalize it so that this is 1, and if you normalize it so that this is 1, then that's E version of the Eisenstein series. And then that, the coefficients of that will have Bernoulli numbers in it. Yes, that's correct. Okay. So there's a nice modular form, and its Fourier coefficients have all sorts of arithmetic functions in it. Okay. So sigma k minus 1 of n is the sum over the divisors of n d to the k minus 1. So it sums of the divisors to the powers. Another popular example is a so-called discriminant function. So there are many ways to define it. You can define it by an infinite product. You can work it out and express it in terms of these normalized Eisenstein series, and then it's 1 over 1728, and I think you get the Eisenstein series of weight 4 raised to the third power minus the Eisenstein series of weight 6 squared. And from here you can see that the weight of this is going to be 12, and since I've subtracted two normalized Eisenstein series, the constant Fourier coefficient is 0, so this is in fact going to be a cusp form of weight 12 for SL2Z. And in fact, this space is one-dimensional, so it's essentially the unique one. And in terms of its Fourier expansion, then the Fourier coefficients of this function, this is the definition of the Ramanujan-Tau function. So that's the Ramanujan-Tau function. And I think so I believe he defined it by taking this product and expanding it out. So there's a cusp form. And then I defined what a cusp form was, but yes, so, sorry. Well, this is one of those deals where you write out your notes, you do things in a certain order, and it's rather methodical, and then you get up here and, you know, things sort of take on a life of their own, and as a result, I forgot to define SK gamma as the space of cusp forms. Okay, so it's a subspace of the space of all modular forms given by the conditions that they vanish at the cusp. Okay. For SL2Z, since there's only the one cusp, then this should be codimension 1 in here. Okay. All right, let me myself back in. Okay, my last example that I wanted to give you is theta series. So here what I'm going to do is I'm going to take Q to be an integral positive definite quadratic form in 2k variables. Okay. And then there's an analytic invariant called a theta series attached to such a quadratic form, and all you do is you sum over the integral lattice of e to the 2 pi I q of m z. And if you sort of expand this out in sort of the usual way we expand a Fourier expansion. This begins with 1, and then it's the sum, n equals 1 to infinity, some numbers which I'll call RQN, e to the 2 pi INC. And it's you can sort of figure out what RQN is. What RQN is, it measures the number of times this quadratic form represents n on the integer lattice. So these are the so-called representation numbers of the quadratic form. And this, it turns out, is always a modular form of weight k. And I think I'm going to put gamma prime here, because it's not really a modular form for either SL2Z or one of the Hecke congruence groups. For it to be a modular form as I've written them, it's probably a modular form for a gamma 1 type group. If I want to do it for gamma naught of n, it actually transforms by a character. So this is, it's for an appropriate discrete subgroup, but it's a little bit different from the ones I've written up. And the reason that I wanted to put these examples up here is just to remind you that one of the classical reasons, one of the reasons that modular forms were found so fascinating classically was because of the occurrence of all of these arithmetic functions in their Fourier expansions. Okay? And if you take that, so this says you can analyze these arithmetic functions in terms of these analytic objects. That's one thing it tells you. But if you think about it, if you combine sort of these things with a statement like this, it says you have many arithmetic functions that you can jam into a single finite dimensional space somehow, and this was one way classically of producing relations among arithmetic functions that seem to have not so much to do with each other. So one of the reasons for the great interest in modular forms were because of the relationship with these arithmetic functions in the Fourier expansions. Okay? And I'm emphasizing this because when we do things on GLN, the Fourier expansion is not going to be so nice. So I want to tell you sort of where these things are hidden in that theory. Okay. All right. I now want to move towards the theory of L functions for these things. Before I do that, I need two growth estimates. So let me give you a couple of elementary growth estimates for cusp forms. So the first growth estimate, so F is going to be a cusp form of weight K for some group gamma, and I'm going to take it to be either SL2Z or one of the gamma naught of N groups, so it contains this integral translation T. Well, the first one just comes from the Fourier expansion. And if I just take this and put on absolute values everywhere, you get that f of x plus iy is bounded by some multiple of e to the minus 2 pi y. Oh, I would think so. Katya distracted me. Okay, so you get an estimate like this. It's uniform in x. So this is as y goes to infinity. It's uniform in x. And there's a similar at any cusp. Okay, and so this says that in fact, and this is related to the question of moderate growth and exponential growth, what this is that cusp forms are actually rapidly decreasing at every cusp. That will be important for us So that's the first estimate. Yeah, you just, I mean, you basically put the absolute values on. Or if you want to do it on the disk, right, you just pull off one power of q, and then you've got a function that has a value at the origin, and so it's, yeah, it's bounded by a constant times z near the cusp. So yeah, that's basically just putting absolute values on the expansion. My handwriting gets bad towards the bottom. That's okay. Second estimate is to note that if you look at f of z and you take its absolute value, now, I mean, this has a transformation law. And if you act by the discrete group, you spit out, I guess, absolute cz plus d to the k. Yeah. Well, it turns out y, if you just look at the transformation law for just the variable y, the imaginary part of z, when you change y by gamma, you spit out absolute value cz plus d squared. So this function is actually invariant on, so it's actually gamma invariant. So let's say is gamma invariant. So descends to a function on gamma mod h. And since f of z is a cusp form, this is rapidly decreasing at the cusps. So even though this has moderate growth, this still vanishes at all the cusps. So in fact, it descends to a function on here, which is bounded on this is bounded. Actually, I don't need it. It's just bounded. So it's bounded on here, okay? Because of this rapidly decreasing of the cusps. So it's a bounded function, okay? And so absolute value of x plus iy is bounded by y to the minus k over 2, okay? Period. And this is uniformly in x. And I'm going to be interested in this as y goes to 0. Okay? So you get such a bound. Well, but then if we look at the way that you actually would compute one of these Fourier expansions, Fourier coefficients, right, so that's the way you compute Fourier expansion of a function that's periodic. You do this computation, you got the nth Fourier coefficient times this negative exponential from the... I do. You're right. Okay. So there's the computation of the nth Fourier coefficient. So from this... if we put absolute values on this, what happens? Well, I put absolute values here. I put absolute values here. And then I take the absolute values inside and use this estimate. This is less than y to the minus k over 2. Okay? And the implied constant here does not depend on y at all. And so... if we evaluate this, at y equals 1 over n, then this becomes a constant, and this becomes n to the k over 2. We get Hecke's bound on the Fourier coefficients of a cusp form. Now, let me just, I'm fixing to talk about the L function, but let me just briefly point out that I really haven't done anything hard. All I've used is one complex variable. Essentially, when I wanted to say things were finite dimensional, I had to invoke Riemann-Roch, but otherwise, this has basically been elementary complex analysis all the way, with some real analysis. But there's been nothing terribly difficult. Okay, and we're going to keep it that way, pretty much. Okay, I now want to talk about the L function of a cusp form. Okay, so let me take, I'm going to wind up writing the Fourier expansion many times, but that's okay. Let me take this to be a cusp form of weight k for one of our discrete groups. Okay. So we've seen that classically, a lot of the interest in these functions came from these arithmetic Fourier coefficients, and that actually, there's even sort of an older traditional way to attach another analytic invariant to a string of interesting numbers like this, and this is through a Dirichlet series. Okay, so Hecke associated to F the Dirichlet series, and now it's called an L function that encodes the same arithmetic data. So I'm going to denote it LSF, and it's the Dirichlet series that you build out of these hopefully arithmetic Fourier coefficients. And from that estimate, from Hecke's estimate, you know that this is absolutely convergent for the real part of S bigger than, oh, it doesn't really matter, but at least k over 2 plus 1. Okay? So that's just another way of encoding this arithmetic information, if you like. Now, what Hecke realized is that you can analyze the analytic properties of this Dirichlet series, and again, the hope is always that by doing analysis, you can eventually get out information on these numbers, which, as we've seen, carry nice information, that the analytic properties of this and S can be derived from the modularity of F because there is an analytic relation between these two analytic objects. So F of an analytic relation via the Mellin transform. So you've done more than just pull these numbers off and stick them in a separate generating function. So what this looks like is the following. If I let lambda of SF be what's called the completed L function, so 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s LSF, then using the integral representation for the gamma function and changing the order of integration, this is just the integral from 0 to infinity f of iy, y to the s t cross y, at least for y, I mean for s sufficiently large so that everything is nicely convergent. Okay, and this is what is called an integral representation for, well, let's just say lambda SF. Okay. So this is a thing that we're going to spend quite a while generalizing during the middle part of these lectures. Okay. Yeah, so this is the multiplicatively invariant measure, so dy over y. Yes. so now let me show you how to derive the most basic analytic properties of the L function, this Dirichlet series, from the modular properties of F. Okay? So let me do this now for the case of SL2Z, which I remind you was generated by the translation that we've used quite a lot, and this inversion, which we have yet to use for anything significant. Okay? And notice what it means for F to be modular with respect to F. So this is F of minus 1 over Z. And if you then write down CZ plus D to the K F of Z, this is Z to the K F of Z. And in terms of things like here, I'm integrating just up Z equals IY, this tells me, so on the line Z equals IY, this tells me that F of I over Y is I to the K, Y to the K, F of IY. Okay. So let me now use this to derive the basic properties of this completed L function. So here's what Hecke did. So Hecke says, all right, let me take this Mellin transform. Let me split the integral into the integral from 1 to infinity and the integral from 0 to 1. Now notice, we've already noted that cusp forms are rapidly decreasing. So this improper integral, this thing is rapidly decreasing as I go up towards infinity. This thing is absolutely convergent for all s. This is an extremely nice function. And if I put s, if I restrict the real part of s, so I put s in a vertical strip, and I put absolute values here, that moves in here to give me the real part of s. This thing is entire and bounded in vertical strips. Okay, just elementary. Okay. This is more difficult because as I let y go to 0, this is the estimate that I have. Okay, which keeps this thing from converging anywhere more than say this region here. Okay. On the other hand, what you can do is just do the change of variables. Whoops. You let y go to 1 over y. Okay? And then once I've got f of I over y, here I'm going to use the modularity. Okay? I stick this in. So I get I to the k, integral 1 to infinity, f of I, y to the k minus s, d cross y. And now, this integral is also nice, because here I have f of I, y, and this is rapidly decreasing as I go off to infinity. So this expression says that this thing is both entire and bounded in vertical strips. And then, if you notice, this expression is symmetric in changing s to k minus s and multiplying by I to the k. So this is I to the k lambda k minus s. Okay. And so that is Hecke's theorem. So it says if F is a cusp form for SL2Z. Then its L function is nice. And now nice is going to, we're going to be using nice throughout the series of lectures, and it's always going to mean the following thing, i.e., it converges absolutely in some right half plane, and it extends to an entire function of S. That extension is bounded in vertical strips. And finally, I want a functional equation. And the functional equation, it turns out, may vary from situation to situation. Nice is always going to mean entire bounded in vertical strips and functional equation of the appropriate sort. And here the functional equation, well, you can just read it off. It's lambda SF is I to the K lambda K minus SF. Okay. So, and again, there was nothing hard in that derivation. It was basically, again, one complex variable. But this is the kinds of things that one always wants to know about L functions, their analytic properties. And these are the most basic ones, whether they have poles, some sort of boundedness, and functional equation. Now, what Hecke noticed was that, in fact, this integral representation, the Mellin transform, has an inverse transform. So that, in fact, if you reverse the whole process, you can actually prove a converse to this theorem. And that's what a converse theorem refers to, is a converse to a theorem like this. So Hecke noticed that he could invert this process. And this is Hecke's converse theorem. And converse theorem always means converse theorem to a theorem like this. It says, you take a Dirichlet series, which is absolutely convergent, some right half plane, and satisfies exactly these three conditions with precisely this functional equation, then if you take f of z and you now reverse the process, so you take the numbers off of this generating function and you stick them in as the Fourier coefficients, then in fact that is a cusp form of weight 12 for SL2Z. Okay? And now let me just run through the proof of this, because it's essentially just inverting that process. So we're just going to invert that process now. So, first off, note from the convergence that the convergence in a half plane gives you some sort of estimates on the coefficients. And you get, I mean, they're just into some power. You get some polynomial estimate on the coefficients coming from the convergence of that Dirichlet series. Okay? So, if you write this just look at this expression, then this converges and is holomorphic on the upper half plane. Okay, so I at least have, by writing down this expansion, I get a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. Okay. Also, here is where I'm going to use that SL2Z is generated by translation and this inversion. And now, note that f of tz, well, is f of z plus 1. And that by construction, this function is periodic. So this is f of z, which is what we expect from modularity. So f is modular with respect to t. So what we need is modularity with respect to S, i.e., well, I think I still have what modularity with respect to S looks like. I need to prove this sort of a relation, okay? Except I've already got that F is holomorphic, and so to prove that, let me come back here. This is a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. This is a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. If I want to prove they're equal, it suffices to prove they're equal along a line, right? And so it suffices to prove this relation, right? So, i.e., by holomorphy, I just need to prove that f of iy, what have I done? F of iy. Oh, okay, well, let me write it that way. That's that relation, just I replaced y by 1 over y. Okay. All right. Okay, so let me do that. And the point is that I have Mellin inversion. So by Mellin inversion, so I'm now going to invert this integral representation. I'm going to invert this integral representation. So f of iy is the sum n equals 1 to infinity a n e to the 2 pi, oops, n y minus. And then what's Mellin inversion? Well, Mellin inversion is you integrate up the real part of s equals something. Let me put it way out where I'm convergent. So c, some c, lambda of s y to the minus s. What did I do? Ah, I know what I did. Okay. dy, where lambda s is the completed version of the Dirichlet series, which I should have put up there in the statement, but I didn't. Okay. Did I? Well, I sort of did. Yeah, in Hecke's theorem, I do. Yes, this is in terms of lambda, but I should have, in some sense, I should have written. I mean, the thing that occurs in the functional equation is that lambda. Okay. Okay. So let me. I'm going to leave that up there and do my computation here. Just so you can, that way I can leave them up here in parallel. Oh, I think there is. And I should integrate ds. That's definitely true. At that point, by the time I'd gotten there, I'd realized I hadn't put in lambda here, so I was off in a different world. Yes, and I think it is just 1 over 2 pi i. Okay, I have to fix that. Okay. Now, I know that lambda f is nice. I know it's bounded in vertical strips. I can sort of shift the line, the contour of integration. So let me write this as f of iy is 1 over 2 pi I. The integral, let me shift to k over 2. Okay. And now I'm just going to use the functional equation. Right? I use the functional equation, and this is 1 over 2 pi I to the k, real part of s k equals 2, lambda to the k minus s y to the minus s ds. Okay? Then I just do the change of variables. I replace s by k minus s. That fixes this line. So this is 1 over 2 pi I integral k over 2 lambda of s y to the s minus k ds. And now let me pull off, whoops, forgot my I to the k. So this is I over y to the k, pulling this y to the minus k out. 1 over 2 pi I integral up the real part k over 2. And then since my original transform had a y to the minus s, I'm going to write this as 1 over y to the s. And this is f at I over y. So I get I over y to the k, f I over y. Which is this. So it's just, and notice there I use the transformation law under s to get the functional equation. Here I use the functional equation to get the transformation law under s. And so that's modularity. Have I proven everything? Oh, cuspidality. Well, it's cuspidal because once I know it's modular, there's its Fourier expansion at infinity. It's the only cusp I have, and it starts at n equals 1. So it's cuspidal. Okay. And now you'll see, we'll see the same argument when we do GLM. Very similar. Okay. I do want to make one comment on gamma naught of n. So let me make a remark. So the problem with gamma naught of n, the first thing to note is that s, which is the thing that we've used all the time in Hecke's derivation, is not in gamma naught of n. Okay? So it's replaced by Sn, which is 0 minus 1 n 0, which is also not in gamma naught of n, but it does normalize it. Now, what this leads you to do is to then show that from this, if you take f of z to be a cusp form of gamma naught of n, then the function g of z, which is defined by n to the minus k over 2, z to the minus k, f minus 1 over nz, is again a cusp form of weight k for gamma naught of n. A little computation for that involves this, the fact that this normalizes gamma naught of n. Okay. And then using this in the Mellin transform, gives, again, that LSF is nice, but satisfying. A functional equation that now looks like lambda SF is n to the k over 2 minus S I to the k lambda k minus S of g. So these two functions get related by the functional equation. And that really is the same proof, basically. You do this, except you do this sort of change of variable in the integral. So this is proved just, I mean, heck, I assume Hecken knew this. I don't know if I remember, looked it up. He must have, though. But inverting it is more of a problem now because even, see, inversion is going to try to give you a transformation law for this thing, and this thing not only doesn't help you generate your group anymore, it's not even in your group. So the converse theorem here is much more difficult, and the converse theorem here is due to they. And let me at least give you the statement. Whoops. What if I've gotten my boards out of whack. That's okay. So this is definitely non-trivial. So here's Vase. Converse theorem. So now you begin with two Dirichlet series. And let them converge in some right half plane. Yep. So one of them is going to be related to F. The other one is going to be related to that function G. Now, for any primitive Dirichlet character, chi, I'm going to twist these things. So I'm going to let D1 of S chi to be the sum chi n a n over n to the S. D2 S chi is the sum chi n b n over n to the S. And then I have the completed versions of either one of these. And this is going to be the sum. What have I done? So, again, 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s lambda I d I s chi. Now, the statement now involves all, essentially all of these Dirichlet series and completed L functions. So it says, suppose there exists an N such that for all primitive Dirichlet characters of conductor, so Dirichlet character chi of conductor q prime to n, we have, well, these are nice. So lambda I s chi extend to entire functions of s. That each one of them is bounded in vertical strips. And finally, We have a functional equation, which now looks like the following. So for each chi, which is relatively prime to n, you have to have this. So lambda 1 s chi is equal to, well, it's something that looks roughly like this, but it has to, but the fact that, that I've twisted things by chi has to come in. So there's I to the k epsilon of chi, I'll tell you what that is in a minute, n q squared to the k over 2 minus s lambda 2 k minus s chi bar. Okay. So I have to have this for every chi. And I have to tell you what epsilon is. Okay, so the epsilon is almost the sign of the Gauss sum, but not quite. So there's the Gauss sum associated to chi. I square it, divide it by the modulus, and then you multiply by chi on n. Okay, so it's a something of absolute value 1. So that's the assumption of nice. So it's entire function bounded in vertical strips. And they have to satisfy this whole family of functional equations for all chi of conductor, primitive chi conductor prime to n. Then, the conclusion is what you would expect, that if you form the two generating functions of the other form, oops, let me give this one a name. Are both cusp forms of weight k for gamma naught of n, satisfying, well, that relation, that g of z is n to the minus k over 2, z to the minus k, f of minus 1 over nz. Okay, so this is Bayes' converse theorem, and there's one essential difference between the proof of it and the proof of Hecke's converse theorem. You still invert the integral representation. You still have to do that, but for Hecke, he essentially proved modularity for the two generators of SL2Z. What Hecke essentially does is he proves modularity for essentially every element of gamma naught of n. He doesn't use generators, okay, or at least not in any strong sense. He essentially proves it for every element of the group. I mean, he really writes the elements in a certain standard form as a product of two or three things of standard form, and then proves it for each one of those, if I remember correctly. No, Bay. Yeah, this is Bay. I'm sorry. No, it's. Yeah, this is Bay for gamma naught of n. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No, that's what Bay does. I mean, he still doesn't sort of use Hecke. He does invert the integral representation that way, but then he has to use all the twists by characters to get the. Yeah, this is definitely Bay. This is definitely Bay. Okay. Whoa. What am I doing? Yes.
Why do they have to speak by all of the characters?
Well, in some sense, you don't have to twist by all the characters. I mean, there's various ways that you can limit this. The first thing that's most natural would be, well, all the difficulty seems to be at n, where I have level. And so the first question would be, well, can I actually only twist, instead of twisting by characters that are unramified, I mean, that are conductor prime to n, can I just twist by characters whose conductor divide n? Or only involve the primes in n? And the answer is, yes, you can do that. There is such a theorem. Now, if you want to do that, if you want to twist my characters that are not primed to the level, the functional equations get much more complicated. And so the thing that you actually have to prove is much harder. Okay? So in some sense, this is a very practical theorem, because what you're doing is you're saying the function that I start with is complicated at n. Those are the primes dividing the level, and I'm only going to torture it at places away from n. Okay? So I'm adding complication not on top of complication, but complementary to complication. So in some sense, it's a very, in that sense, it's a practical theorem, because you can actually use it. Now, there are also versions for gamma naught of n for small n where you can control generators. You can replace the twist by characters by having an Euler product expansion. This is what Connery and Ghosh have, no, Connery and Farmer have done in low, for low n, small values of n, where they can control generators. And you can do a combination of the two methods. This has been done recently. So there are other versions twisting at other places. But this one's the one that actually does seem to be the most useful. Also, I'm running a little bit behind, so but that's okay. I want to point out that nowhere in either of these theorems is anything assumed about an Euler product for the L function. So in these, in this development so far, we've seen the Euler product plays no role, actually. I mean, everything up to this point was really fairly elementary. All right, let me, all right, I have to make a decision here. Okay, and I think I'll have to pay for this further down the line, I think. I was going to tell you about the Euler product expansion for a form. I still want to do that. I can't do it in 5 minutes. So I think I'll just do this. I'll start next week by doing a little bit more on the classical theory to show you the Euler product expansion, remind you where that comes from. And then after I do that, then we'll start the transition from classical forms to automorphic forms on GL2 of the Adels to automorphic forms on GLN to automorphic representations. We'll start that. We'll go through that transition and try to see where things like the conditions of modularity, regularity, and the growth condition for classical forms, how they translate. I want to see things like how the L function having an Euler product translates and let you see how some of these things translate. And I do want to talk some about, like I said, modular automorphic forms of smooth automorphic forms, which are not, I think, a very standard way of thinking about automorphic forms anymore. They used to be quite standard to think about smooth ones. Now people usually either think of automorphic forms as being K-finite, or they think of them as being L2, and the smooth one sits somewhere in between. And at least for the analytic theory of L functions, like I'm going to develop, you need to work in that in-between realm, as it turns out. So I'll talk a little bit about those. And that'll be enough for the first day, I guess. Thank you.